This is episode 16 in this season of the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks for joining us as we look back on the Champions Cup final, look ahead to the Pro 14 semi-finals, and discuss some of the other rugby stories of the last week. You can listen to our podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other podcast apps, and you'll also find links on the RTE Sport website and on our sport social media accounts. For this episode, we're joined by one of our regular rugby analysts, James Downey, ex-Munster, Northampton, Ireland and others, and by Against the Head editor Wes Liddy. And we'll also hear very shortly from BBC Radio rugby correspondent Chris Jones on Saracens, the Premiership and London Irish. But first, to look back on that Champions Cup final, and James, your overall reflections on it.
Yeah, I think when you look back at that game, you see a lot of missed opportunities there, and I'm sure the Leinster boys will have had a debrief during the week, and it wouldn't have been great viewing, to be honest, you know. And I think people at the time thought, look how well Sarries had done, but ultimately when you look back, it's a missed opportunity, and you're not going to get that chance again. I think you see the points that they left out, especially second half. We spoke about it, and Gary Ringrose, four men outside him, and leaving that small points but little things. And just before half time, 10-3 up would have been perfect going in at half time. And just again letting Sarries back into it, and that's just these. Look, to at the
strange decision making.
It is, and I think you look at like Sarries, what they do and what they're very good at is that slowing it down. They're very precise. They're very rigid in how they start a game, and they'll get into place. And everyone knows their job, and it's little things that they do extremely well. Catch a kickoff, set it up, maybe one pass, box kick, kick chase. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it works. And I wouldn't say bores people, but the guys know their roles and they know their jobs, and it stifles opposition and frustrates them. And you could see, I think Leinster didn't kick at all nearly. I think out of Johnny's.
Would the likes of the Gary Ringrose incident, not that specific incident, but do players start to make kind of scrambled decisions as a product of the pressure that Saracen's defence is putting on you, or the physicality they're bringing to things?
I think so, yeah. I think you're out there and you're under that position, and it's like, okay, here's a wall again. But sometimes I thought they could have used a couple of things against, when you saw how they played against Munster, and to take the line speed off, you've got to put the ball in behind, you know, and to make teams repeat it and repeat coming off the line and repeat coming off the line. To take some line speed out, you chip it or you put it in behind. But if you keep running into that wall, it's just going to galvanise the Sarries pack, as it did. And when we did have opportunities, guys just didn't push it wide. It's very kind of un-Leinster-like in how they didn't shift it as wide as I thought they did. They lost the battle of the gain line and ultimately the losing of the match.
Chris, you were at the stadium, pretty much sold out. As an occasion, what was it like as a final?
Yeah, I thought it was a brilliant occasion. Newcastle does big sporting events really well, and just the atmosphere around town on the Friday night, Saturday, Leinster fans travelled in force. It was an awesome occasion, it really was. And I mean, being there, it was a great game. I mean, I think a few of us have discussed in the past week whether it was a great game for rugby purists, and maybe it wouldn't have had that massive kind of cut-through impact, like, say, the Champions League football would have had in the week with kind of the man and woman on the street. But yeah, in terms of an occasion, it was brilliant. And as the guys are saying there, Sarries did what they do, and Leinster really had no answer to that sheer physicality on the gain line.
And Sarries now, in fact, talking to Wes, you were saying earlier in the week in the office that perhaps Sarries are the best team ever in the Champions Cup, despite the fact they don't yet have the most titles. I mean, your thoughts on that?
Well, they don't have the most titles, but they have the most titles with one team, as opposed to Toulouse won their four with several different sides. Leinster won their four with two different sides. So 3 and 4 years, including a back-to-back, coupled with the success they've had in the Premiership, if you look at any of the criteria, like if you look at the talent across the board in the team, if you look at the kind of identity and culture they now have there, I mean, I agree with James, maybe they're not aesthetically the most, like they're not as pleasing to watch as Leinster under Joe were, for example, but you know, they're not as one-dimensional as people make out either. I mean, they do have they have an excellent back three. They've very good halfbacks. They're Toulon's team was probably better 1-15 on paper, but I don't know if Toulon had the same kind of maybe deep roots to the to the club is a bit much, but to this particular team, I think this Sarri's kind of project has evolved over nearly a decade now, and that's kind of added to their armoury as well. And to be honest, don't want to be giving anyone a bad name, but you kind of wonder why Mark McCall wasn't sounded out more for coaching vacancies in this country, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Chris, despite their success, though, they're not loved, are they, in England? Or what's the view of the English rugby public? Even if you're not a Saracen supporter, what do other people think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, there is definitely an element, an air of hostility, I should say, towards Saracens. That could be for a number of reasons. They basically, because they don't have the rich history, the tradition, the fan base of a Leicester, a Northampton, of a Bath, they've had to create their own culture. They've had to create their own identity. They've always done things very differently. You know, they've had names for their defence, the Wolfpack defence. They have this kind of very holistic mentality at the club, which a lot of other players outside the club roll their eyes at. But if you're on the inside, you absolutely love it. People come from another club to Saracens and probably think, oh, I don't know what this culture is all about. Once they're in it, they never leave. You know, it's almost like indoctrinations. It sort of has a negative, sinister connotation. But once you are on the inside at Saracens, you never want to leave. They have an unbelievably tight culture. They have the roots that, with the young players coming through, means that they've got more and more success in the squad. Whether they're liked or not, they're probably not, and that mainly comes from jealousy. A little bit of it is about the way they play, which I think is a reputation that they've probably shaken recently. They score a lot of tries. You know, look at the way they've beaten Glasgow, for example, in the Champions Cup this season, putting 50 points on them and running in 9 tries, I think it was, in the second game. So they know how to play. They just do the basics really well in the first place. And also this kind of the lingering suspicion about the salary cap and whether they're completely abiding by the rules. They're currently being investigated by Premiership Rugby because of these business dealings that owner Nigel Ray has with senior players. It might be that it's above board. It might be that it isn't. We're still waiting to find out. But when you put all those reasons in the mix, they are not the most loved club by those on the outside, but certainly those at the club, you know, couldn't love it anymore. And you see that with the way they play for each other and the success that's come from that.
And the Mark McCall question, as Wes mentioned, he might have been sounded out here. I was more regularly on the beat when he was coaching up in Ulster, and he was shook the end of it. Like,
there was a lot went on there, from what I know. Now, to be honest with you, I don't get the impression Mark McCall necessarily be mad to come back and take a job. I think, as Chris said, he does seem to love it on the inside there. I mean, but
he moved his family over when he'd young.
Well, he's
kids.
Very good friends with Conor O'Shea as well, and I know they were near each other in London before Conor took the Italy job, and David Humphreys is kind of part of that triumvirate as well, I think, and he's in England now. So, like, I agree with what Chris was saying. Like, they have kind of done things over the years that you roll your eyes at. Like, if you even go back to, you know, when Pinar and Sella and them were at the club with, you know, getting the radio control car to bring the kicking tee out into the pitch and the fezzes and all this lark. But they kind of seem to have waded through the crap and arrived at a fairly solid place now after kind of 15 or 20 years of trial and error, you know. So, I mean, look, fair play to them, really.
And I also see various reports in English papers or websites about McCall possibly succeeding Eddie Jones, but he's signed up for SARS until 2022. Do you see Saracens remaining at the very top of the English game? As you say, once they get somebody, they seem to hold on to them.
Yeah, I think they're here to stay. I mean, they've already won 4 titles in recent years and 3 Euros. So there's 7 major trophies since McCall properly took over in 2010. So the record's astonishing. The young players keep coming through. If you look at their current crop, people like Jamie George and Owen Farrell, Itoje, George Cruz, Alex Good, they've all come through the academy. They're still in their 20s. They've still got a fair bit of rugby to play. Good's actually just turned 31. But on the whole, players like Ben Spencer at 26 have got years left in them. They're coming to their peak. And McCall's a fascinating one because, you know, from this part of the world, you're thinking, why is the RFU not banging down his door? And also you're thinking, why is the English RFU not banging down his door? Because his track record is unbelievable. And I think maybe he suffers from the fact that he doesn't shout about it. He's incredibly quiet. He doesn't hog the limelight. He puts all the attention onto the players. He's not one of those coaches who says, I want to be this coach, I want to be that coach, I want to do the Lions, I want to take over the world. He very much says he's happy where he is. But, you know, when England look for a successor to Eddie Jones, they might look again for a big hitter who's been there there and done it on the international stage. But if English rugby's serious about properly joining up the club game and the international game, personally, I think it makes sense to look to the best director of rugby in the country. And at the moment, the best director of rugby operating in England is Mark McCall by a street.
What do you think on that, James?
Yeah, no, I agree with what's been said. I think having played against Sarries myself a good few years ago now, I think there was that sort of element of jealousy of, you used to hear all the stories about what they used to do in their private planes and after games and over to Oktoberfest, and okay, I guess you want to be part of that. And when we weren't getting it, you know, it was quite frustrating. But look, it's just, it's one of these clubs that, as you say, Chris, that identity and that culture is very different to establish when you don't have that past. And this is the way they've done it. And every player I speak to now, they speak so highly of the environment. And as you say, once you're in that environment, they all have a buy into it. And you know where you stand, you know where, like, they do send you out pretty quickly and let you know what the story is in terms of, I know some of the players will say, right, you're going to get 3 weeks to play and you've 1 week off, regardless of how you're playing. So everyone gets a chance to get some form together, to get some game time. And then for the big European games, then we'll come down to a selection. So you can be man the match and on your third game and you'll still not play the next week and the next player will come in. So everyone gets a chance to get game time. And I do agree with the way they've played as well now. And at the start, they do frustrate teams and kind of nearly bore them a little bit, but then they do open up, and when they do, you see the players they have, and that Wes mentioned the back three, and Liam Williams has been certainly one of a great purchase, you know, and he's kicked them on another level. But as for Mark McCall, look, he's been there, he's done it now at the moment, and
he won a trophy in Ulster as well. People forget they haven't won one since, you know. He won the Celtic League in 2005, you know.
Yeah, but it's just, look, to see someone go over there, maybe because he is so quiet and unassuming, that he's over there and he's put his head down and just ground out, but his results, like his record speaks for itself, and how consistent he's been, and look, he just gets on with it, doesn't he, and doesn't shout about it, as we've mentioned there. And
that'd be a good documentary now, to place Mark McCall next to James here as the evolution of professional rugby, the size of number 12s 10 years apart, how it changed.
Yeah, and getting bigger still. Just going back to Leinster though, there was a sort of an inevitability in the last 20 minutes. It just didn't look like they could get back in. The margin on the score wasn't that big, but I think a lot of people almost gave up on them. Is that fair to say? The casual watchers anyway?
Perhaps casual watchers, but I think, again, that's credit to how Sarries play and frustrate. And you look at Leinster, had a lot of possession. They worked so hard to get into that Sarries 22. And then you have killer moments where you get turned over. Liam Williams, and be it on his feet or off his feet, it was an epic bit of play, to be honest, to tackle, get up and poach, and all of a sudden release that pressure. And how hard Leinster had to work to get into that 22, to get into that position. And on more than one occasion, they were turned over, and just that relentless defence that Sarries have brought. And I think when you flip it around and look at how Sarries played, with all the big ball carriers they have, and look, Will Skelton's lost whatever it is, 20 kilos around, and he's still able to run onto the ball in the 60 minute and get yards and easy yards, you know. And it's
incredible, actually, the shape he's
in. Yeah, exactly. And that's a credit to what they've done. And even Vinopola putting in a big stint again. And like, he's a big man. Sometimes he can go missing, not then, you know. And when they have their tails up, they're extremely tough to stop.
I mean, that stat, though, is Sean O'Brien, 13 or 14 carries for a net gain of 1 metre. Is obviously, physicality is a massive part of it, but is that super asset for Saracens?
I think, though, there's always these mini trends every few years in terms of whether it's tactical or body shape stuff. And probably starting with the All Blacks at the last World Cup, there was this commitment to players trimming down a few kilos because the ball and play time was up. And that's followed a lot. And we've probably embraced it this year. You know, you've heard of Cian Healy being 6 kilos lighter than he was, and a couple of other. Dave Kilcoyne has slimmed down. Lots of guys. And look, their form has been good for it, but either there could possibly be a swing back now if you look at the size of that Sarries pack, or you look at what England did to Ireland in the Six Nations. But equally, I think, like, the Irish system and a lot of what the provinces do is built on being really good at the basics, being relentless about it, doing it really efficiently. And, like, without being disparaging, that takes advantage of sometimes less organised or less motivated opposition. But if the opposition matches you for organisation and discipline, and then has that extra physicality and power that Mako, Billy, Jamie George, Tidi Lamositele, whoever Will Skelton bring to the party. Well, I mean, a good big and always beats a good little, and it's as simple as that, really, I think.
I think Sarri's brought a lot more line speed, and you feed off your defence, and especially, like, people talk about defensive winning your cups, you know, and titles, and I think this is a case in point. If you look at how Leinster defended, they didn't actually come up as fast or as hard as I thought they were going to come up, you know, and try and get in their faces. They kind of sat in their heels a little bit. And
surely
against
if
big
you're
men,
physically outgunned, you need to do that even more.
I would have thought that, but yet the bigger guys, as you're saying, the more physically imposing Sarri's pack, were able to bring that line speed and bring it consistently. And I think Leinster struggled in that defensive aspect because Sarri's got quick ball. And when you're on the back foot and you've big men coming onto the ball, like if you look at Leinster were taking it static and expecting to make gain line. If you're catching the ball static and you've a big guy running at you, it's going to be hard to make yards, you know. As you said, that's an interesting stat with Sean O'Brien, that those carries for a yard or two, which just goes to show, you know, that pressure that he's under, or that ball that Leinster are getting was so slow that they couldn't actually get that momentum.
You see it with CJ Stander as well now. I mean, his carries in terms of volume are still huge,
yeah,
but the amount of yardage per carry he's making compared to a couple of years ago, and I think in his case, like, I mean, I'm sure someone inside the camp might laugh at you, but it seems like he's almost too honest for his own good. Sometimes he'll continue to present for these thankless carries where the goal is to recycle rather than break a tackle. And I think that's kind of that's something that kind of is a product of the way we've played. Maybe it's something we need to kind of look at a little bit.
I actually don't think it's necessarily like CJ at his best is when he gets that go forward. I think opposition go, stop CJ, stop that momentum. And I'm sure Leinster came into this weekend, stop Billy. You know, easier said than done, 100%. You still got to do it. And if you don't, the team get galvanised from a small little percentages and just that little boost, you know, and they were unable to do it. Stop him, he goes quiet. Other people start looking around. You ask questions. But if you don't, he's in the game and he's a force to be reckoned with. Same with CJ, I think. I think if you can stifle him and teams have, he's quiet. And if he's in the game and he gets a couple of carries, he's everywhere, you know. And I think it's just one of those things I thought Leinster may have put a bit more pressure on.
Chris, if I can just bring you back in and just look at I'm looking at the Premiership table at the moment, and Saracens aren't actually, for all the high praise we're giving them, they're not actually top of the table. Now, I know matches go on during international windows and all that kind of thing, but they're 4 points behind Exeter. They've both got 16 wins out of 21. Are they strong favourites to lift the Premiership? And B, in terms of the playoff positions, there's one regular set of matches to go. What do you see happening there?
Yeah, I mean, on Saracens, it doesn't really matter that they're second from their point of view. They've won titles from fourth before. Their whole thing is peaking come the last day of the season. And Exeter have actually been brilliant up until the last month, and they've dropped a few games recently, and all their momentum has gone. So they've got to play Northampton at home, Exeter, and not just would they like to win to seal top spot, they've already got a home semi, but they want to win just to get some momentum back and some confidence and some cohesion back. If they do win Exeter, that probably puts Northampton out of the running, because Harlequins would probably back themselves at Wasps, because Wasps don't have a huge amount to play for, outside shot maybe of top six. That fourth place is up in the air, but certainly you've got to make Sarri's favourites, just because they don't really mind who they play. They don't mind whether they're home or away. If they are at home and play Gloucester in the semi-final, it's really hard to see any team winning on Allianz Park, especially on that pitch, which a lot of teams hate playing on. And then when you get to a one-off final, again, it's hard to bet against Sarri's if the likes of Mako and Billy Vanapola and Jamie George and George Cruz and Owen Farrell, if they're fit and top of their game, they're going to be so hard to beat in a one-off final. So yeah, Exeter are top, but they've been stumbling, and Sarri's are just coming to the boil, aren't they? They've got one trophy. They've spent 3 days on the lash, and now they're looking for another one.
Right. And looking to next season, we know that London Irish are coming up, and Newcastle, with the City having hosted the Champions Cup final, unfortunately, they're for the drop. But London Irish, they've signed Wasaki Naholo, Paddy Jackson, Sean O'Brien, a few Australians, Nick Phipps, Akoke Kepu, Curtis Rona, and others. I think Alan Dell is coming from Edinburgh. Hard to make that leap into the Premiership, but wow, they're certainly spending big to try and do it, aren't they?
Yeah, and this is the problem English rugby faces, and there's actually meetings going on today about whether this structure is sustainable. I don't think it is, because it shouldn't be the case. You've got to spend this amount of money and recruit this calibre of player to bridge the gap between the Tier 2 and Tier 1. I mean, there's a gap in the football, but if a team is well prepared and does its transfer dealings well, you've seen what Wolves can do. You don't have to buy a million players in the summer to deal with the Premier League. You do. The gap in rugby, the gap between Premiership and Championship is too big at the moment. So London Irish have done what Bristol have done. When Bristol came up a few years back, they recruited one or two and they were nowhere near good enough. This time they recruited Stephen Luatua and Charles Peartow and brought in George Smith and others, and they've been able to, you know, finish mid-table or so. Bristol and London Irish are trying to do the same. So the danger maybe is that Newcastle get cast adrift, but again, the gap between Premiership and Championship is so big, you'd expect Newcastle to bounce back up. And then there's a lot of talk that the RFU and the Premiership Rugby will make it a 13-team league and then have a playoff, just to avoid this situation where teams go up and down like a yo-yo, and there's actually no real great fluidity between the Championship and the Premiership, because at the moment it's not really working.
Well, could it be ring fenced at 13 and effectively?
I think
someone goes out
well
of business
against that. Yeah, I think it's a good question. The ring fencing is something that's always on the table. I think if you ring fence, then what does that say about the, you know, teams in Tier 2 that might have ambitions of being a top flight club? Everyone uses the example of Exeter, who are miles away in 2008-09, and then come 2010 they're a Premiership side, and come 2019 they're regularly in Premiership finals. So it can be done, but it needs a huge amount of money, a huge amount of investment, infrastructure, recruitment, fan base, all these things that so many teams in the second division don't have. So they want to maybe leave the door open for a Cornish Pirates or a Coventry or an Ealing, if they do get everything together, to come up. But I think the it's going to be a playoff at best, all ring fencing. As it stands, it's not really working, because there just aren't enough teams in that second division who can make the leap up.
OK, well, we're going to go ahead and preview the Pro 14 semi-finals. But Chris Jones, BBC Rugby correspondent, thanks a million for joining us.
My pleasure. Chat soon. Cheers, guys.
And we are now going to look ahead to the Guinness Pro 14 semi-finals. Of course, it's Glasgow against Ulster on Friday night. That's live in an extended Game on RT2FM. And then Leinster-Munster at the RDS, 2:30 kick-off. Full commentary on that in Saturday Sport. Now, Joey Carberry is likely to be back for Munster. He was put up for interview during the week, and our commentator Michael Corcoran spoke to him firstly about the departures, yet to happen but already announced, of Gerry Flannery and Felix Jones from the Munster coaching staff.
Yeah, it's obviously pretty sad, but look, they're great guys, great coaches, and like, we got on so well off the pitch as well as on the pitch. So look, it's very sad to see them leave. Wish them well. Their contribution has been second to none this year. The work they put in behind the scenes, and it's just, like, they're such hard workers. So whatever they go into next, I'm sure they'll be flying at it.
Now, over the last number of weeks, even months, I've seen various parts of Joey Carberry training in the corner of the pitch on your own, then integrated back into training, then almost making it, now standing in front of me. So that kind of, in my head, means there's a bit of progress being made. Where are you right now in terms of your health and fitness?
Yeah, I'm in a good stage, I think. It's been a long couple of months, I must say. It's been annoying getting close and then having to come back and getting close again. So it's a frustrating one, but we just kind of said to ourselves that I had to be 100% before I come back. So I'm close now, which is good, and hopefully back on the pitch soon enough.
Rugby players are people who like to be involved. I mean, when you're not involved because of injury, that must be probably one of the most frustrating things. I mean, it's almost like a huge mental challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's tough because you're on a different schedule to the boys as well, so you're not seeing them as often. And I suppose what I try to do is just make sure I sit out at training, watching training, keep my eye in. So yeah, it's been tough, but look, the last 2 or 3 weeks I've been training with the lads, and it's great to be back and hopefully get out on the pitch again soon.
And training and kicking, particularly, is kicking going okay? Is every aspect of your game all right at this stage?
Yeah, I've been, like, the S&C guys are on the ball for that kind of stuff. In between runs and rehab, I've been doing kicking and passing and stuff like that to make sure that doesn't kind of fall down anywhere. So, no, it's been good, but it's not the same when you're not doing it out on the pitch, really. It's pretty tough.
Did you have a look at all at the Champions Cup final over the weekend? I mean, obviously the two best teams that were left in the competition went toe-to-toe. I mean, did it kind of make you see or reinforce even more where Munster need to get to get back to that level?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it was obviously a cracking game, and as a spectator, it was great to watch. But look, I think Saracens are a serious outfit, and I think we kind of were in there as well, like Leinster were. So it just shows that we're not too far off. I think obviously a few things definitely to work on, but we're not too far off. So I think that spurs us on a bit more as well, like, because obviously we want to be tasting that and be playing in those games. So look, hopefully what's come out of this season, anyway, in the European Cup, we learn from and build on, hopefully, then for this week.
When you think back to the last encounter, Munster, Leinster, Thomond Park, December 29th, I mean, it was kind of a spiky enough affair, but it showed the rivalry and probably great respect that everybody has for each other.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's both teams kind of that know each other so well, going out to prove a point. So, yeah, it's an exciting game to be playing in, especially up in the RDS. I'm sure it'll be packed. Hopefully the weather's all right as well. But no, it's an exciting time of the season now with knockout rugby, and I think it just builds everything, so we're focusing 100% on ourselves to try and get ourselves in the right place to win it.
And when you look at the RDS, they put in additional seating for this. I mean, you know the venue quite well. I mean, it's kind of intimate, very, very atmospheric. It must even be difficult to communicate with your fellow players on the pitch.
Yeah, it gets pretty loud. The crowd are very close to the pitch as well, which is, it's obviously great for us being out on the pitch listening to. So, yeah, we're really looking forward to it. And like I said, look, we'll try and get ourselves best right we can for it. A lot of work to be doing, but it was good to have last week. We kind of got a good bit of training done, so it's exciting. We're really looking forward to it.
That's Joey Carberry, likely to play for Munster against Leinster on Saturday afternoon. As I said, full live commentary from the RDS on Saturday Sport on RTE Radio 1. James Downey, Leinster on a downer, obviously. Munster with everything to play for and maybe finally get a trophy, but can they turn over Leinster in the RDS, do you think?
Straight up answer to that, yeah, I think they can, actually. I think you look, Leinster aren't used to losing finals and certainly not used to losing European finals, and to pick yourself back up and go into a derby, and you look at the position that you said, how Munster are and how they've lost a lot of semi-finals, and this is a great chance, I think, for Munster to do a job on them, to be honest. Will it happen? Not sure. Like, last weekend's game was extremely physical. I'm sure they'll be well rested. Look, the thing about Leinster is they know how to win these games as well, and it'll be interesting to see if they rotate much of the squad, if at all, to kind of be rolled out again the next week, having had such a tough game. Look, it's part of it, but I just think it's a great chance for Munster to take it. If Leinster had won there at the weekend, I would have said no way. No matter who comes up, I just think that Leinster just have that nice, but just that little chink in the armour now, they might be a little bit vulnerable.
You think changes in the Leinster team would be minimal, do you?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think you can change too much, really. Maybe a scrum half. You've got Gibson Park coming back, who I think was actually missed at the weekend. We never mentioned him in the earlier stint, but I think he brings a good bit of tempo. Where else I would see changes? Not too sure, really.
Johnny is the interesting one. This game last year, they brought Ross Byrne in, you know, in very similar circumstances, and he doesn't tend to get three starts on the bounce, Johnny, but at the same time, such a big game. Big
Took
call
a big
to leave
bang
him out.
In the Champions Cup final as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose the flip side of that is Ross Byrne with Carberry opposite him would probably be hugely motivated to deliver as well. It's not like you're bringing in chopped liver. He's a pretty good player in his own right. Absolutely. So, kind of interesting what will happen there, but, I think, as well,
they've spoken before about, oh, Joey be fit and he'd be grand, and then he's pulled out again.
Yeah.
Like,
and even if he is fit, he hasn't played in so long.
Yeah,
at this
exactly.
Point,
I think there's a bit of vulnerability there. I do think that you come back against an opposite or a team you've played for and you're motivated that way. But he's got to kind of, he's already played against him, of course, like, but he's got to kind of put that to the side. And
I think JJ is actually ahead of Tyler Blaindale if Joey isn't a player, is to be substituted at some point as well.
Yeah, well, I think if you're looking at kind of impact and get, like, Tyler would be one you'd start if you were going to play. And then afterwards, when the game loosens up, JJ is your man to come on and kind of and finish it. But yeah, it's a great chance, I think, for Munster to take. Taking the scalps a bit much, but I do think it's a great opportunity for that Munster side.
And yet Munster at home to Benetton in the quarter final or the semi final qualifier, as it was called as well,
yeah,
whatever way you want to call it. They weren't exactly.
I suppose when you go out of Ulster or when you go out of Europe, you know, there is a bit of a downer to deal with, especially when you go out as conclusively as they did for the umpteenth consecutive occasion. But it's just a question of how much have they been able to rally in the kind of intervening few weeks, you know. And if they're bouncing off the wall and they've really got themselves in the right place, there's absolutely an opportunity there for them. But I suppose it was quite similar last year. There was one or two points in it at the end. In fairness, the Munster score came right at the death. So it was possibly not quite an accurate representation of what had gone before. But, I mean, these are the games you're kind of... Like, they were underdogs against Saracens. It wasn't that surprising they lost, no. Really. But, I mean, I suppose if you're kind of trying to evaluate the progress made under Van Graan, you know, you're looking at last year and what was his first season where he didn't even have the full season, and you're saying they had umpteen opportunities to put Leinster away at the RDS, and it was that lack of being able to, like, passing skills, being able to play expansively when the opportunity arose that cost them. This is the exact kind of game now that you get a clear barometer of how much progress has been made. The evidence from the Saris game was not much, but I think Saracens were exceptional. So you'd be hoping with Chris Farrell there, maybe with Joey back, that from a Munster perspective, that they can deliver something more than they did last year. And if they do, I'd agree with James. I think that they have every chance, you know. But at home, yeah, I think it's fair that the bookies would still tip Leinster marginally, you know.
Yeah. Are you tipping Leinster?
It's hard to say, really.
I know you're biased. But
I'm not biased at all. I know what you're talking about. I think it's, I think it really depends on what mindset both teams turn up in. I know that sounds like a complete cliche, but you'll tell very early on Saturday, I think, where they're at and get a good read in it from there. I mean, yeah, I'd probably veer with Leinster marginally, but can Munster win? Absolutely, yeah. I mean, no, of course they can.
What about the other semi, Glasgow, Ulster? I mean, Ulster post-Christmas have stepped it up big time.
They have stepped it up, but just kind of looking at some of the stats on Glasgow and how good Glasgow are at home as well, I find this one a bit more kind of one-sided. I'd straight away go Glasgow on this, just like scoring 83 tries at home against Ulster 60. And last time they won in April 5th, and it was 30-7 to Glasgow, both teams full side. So I just think that Glasgow have that motivation, and at home and on that 4G track, it's too heavily weighted for them at the moment, I think.
Wes?
Yeah, probably. Although I think Ulster can be quite unpredictable at times, and they'll probably go and play as well. And that pitch adds another bit of a variable into things. So I wouldn't be amazed if it was a kind of a high-scoring shootout that could end up going either way. But yeah, on evidence, you'd have to say Glasgow are favourites. But I mean, look, since the Leinster semi-final, there's definitely signs Ulster going the right direction. Another good signing yesterday, Matt Faddies. And I actually think Bill Johnston will be very curious to see how he goes when he goes up there next year. I mean, I think he probably hasn't got as many opportunities as he should have had in Munster. He was very highly rated all the way up through the underage rank. So I could easily see a situation next year he goes in and maybe puts it right up to Billy Burns or becomes a starter even there, you know.
But if it is the end of the road for Ulster, overall thoughts on Dan McFarlane's first season in charge?
Yeah, I think he's been pretty impressive in what he's done. And you see, I know we're talking about like kind of missed opportunities earlier on, and I think that you look at that Leinster game and how far they've come on, and that was theirs for the taking, and they'll be kicking themselves. But again, look, another semi-final, potentially final. I think it's been a good year. Dan's got a good grasp of how things are, and he's putting his stamp on how the side are playing. And look, I think to have Kutsia playing back fit has been huge. He's been a great player this year. So if he stays fit, Ulster can go well.
Yeah. I think he's done well, you know, definitely. I mean, sure, like, Jesus. No doubt there's been progress.
Just two more things to finish with, guys, then. The Ireland under-20s, Grand Slam champions, World Cup coming up in Argentina. Squad announced today, but they're missing a few key players.
Yeah, I saw him playing against Leinster, actually, last Friday morning against Leinster development team. Impressive in parts. They're missing very important players in Harry Byrne and Scott Penny, I suppose. And I think it's an unbelievably cutthroat tournament, much more so than the Senior World Cup, because if you lose your first game, you're going into this kind of fifth to eighth repechage system rather than you can come second in your group and you still evolve in the main tournament. So it's really unforgiving to start off with England rolling to Australia. But they're a funny team to watch. Like, they did brilliantly to win a Grand Slam, and I don't know, I was kind of wondering during the Six Nations, were they maybe a very good team, but the graduation to playing senior for Ireland mightn't necessarily be huge. Like, there's a few of them that are a little bit physically challenged for senior international rugby, like in terms of size maybe, but like the smallest guy in the pitch was probably their most impressive performer, and Craig Casey, who he was, you know, yapping away there against Leinster the other day, as usual, getting in everyone's face. He's brilliant to watch, and didn't see as much of Sean French in the Six Nations as I thought we would, and he looks phenomenal, was phenomenal for Carcon in the AIL final as well. So we don't produce too many backs with those physical attributes that he has, you know.
James, any views on the prospects?
Yeah, and I think it's such a huge test as well. Like, England will be hurting from Ireland beating them in Six Nations, and it's going to be a big test. And like, talking about physicality, first up, you've got the big English boys, you know, who a lot of players, or a lot of coaches as well, would have tipped to win that Six Nations. A lot of those boys get a lot of premiership rugby, a bit of game time over there, so especially in key positions. And look, I just think that they are missing some of those big players, as well as mentioned. And if they can get that momentum, it's all about team in this under-20s environment, that you can have some great individuals, but if that team aspect comes into it over the course of an intense couple of weeks, you know, it's like 4-day turnaround. It's attritional. It's the squad. It's not your first 15. It really is your squad, because you're not going to play the same 15.
That rule, it's not in the under-20s, but I know in the under-18s European Championship, for example, you have to use X amount of players over the course of your pool game. So, like, the rotation is massive, you know. Every one of those the vast majority of them will certainly see game time. No, but
you look at the schedule, and you've got in 8 days, you've got 3 games in 8 days. Like it's you can't. One or two players may, but most of the squad will all get a chance and will play. So
I think the bigger countries as well, like England, because of the volume of players they have, New Zealand because maybe of the genetic pool they're drawing from with Polynesian players and that. I mean, you can really be physically outgunned in this tournament. I think that's always the worry you have with Ireland. You know, it's never for a lack of bravery or necessarily even quality, but like, I'd say playing any of the baby black sides at this end, I mean, it's probably not a million miles off playing a senior international side in terms of what you're going to physically encounter.
Yeah. Just two other things then. Two Irish coaches in the news. Yesterday, at one stage, report was that Conor O'Shea was going to depart Italy after the World Cup, but in fact he's not. He's staying till after the Six Nations, but don't know where he's going to go after that. That's the 2020 Six Nations. And then Ronan O'Gara giving an interview, reading the quotes, seems to possibly be leaning towards La Rochelle, but there are other things possible. He said he wouldn't come back to Munster, though, unless as a head coach. So any views on where the two of those might end up next?
Not really. I don't know. I wonder, was Rog scared off coming back to Munster as an assistant by what's happened the last few weeks? But if that was ever on the cards, but who knows, you know. But he's certainly building a very good CV for himself, Rog, and making all the right noises. So I imagine it's only a matter he could end up in Andy Farrell's ticket in some shape or form either, you know.
Yeah, there's plenty of opportunities there for him. And it's just like you hear in how he says in his quotes, and he's looking at family. He can stay in Crusaders, he can go to La Rochelle, he can potentially come back to these shores, which may look a little bit unlikely, but he's a shrewd operator, and look, no doubt he'll be back eventually. You know, it's just a matter of when and when suits him, I think, and when everything falls into the right place. I don't think now is the moment for him to be a Munster, certainly not.
And have you any notions on when Conor O'Shea does leave Italy, if he does stay in coaching or direct for a rugby role, what would be an attractive job for him, do you think?
It's very hard to say, really. I mean, I know Conor fairly well from his time working here, but and like he's certainly a guy that knows his own mind, but I did kind of always struggle to see the attraction of that Italy job. I mean, aside from financial, which is obviously significant, but, you know, there's a lifestyle choice that's nice. I think the family live near Lake Garda, and I'm sure it's idyllic and all the rest of it. But to me, it was always kind of a bit of a hiding to nothing, that job. So
you're never going to emerge with a positive win percentage anyway.
Well, a positive win percentage is winning one game in the Six Nations every year. And they haven't done that. So I mean, he's needing a big World Cup to leave. Now, I suppose he can point to this stuff that's happened under the surface in terms of the Pro 14 teams have improved a lot and their underage results.
And that was always part of his thing.
It was, but like, you know, you'd imagine you'd like to see that through to fruition a bit more. So, I don't know. I mean, he could end up working in GB Sport or the IOC or, you know, he's kind of a...
Clive Woodward-esque.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, it's... I mean, I suppose the one that people always think is... You know, that David Nusavora role was kind of always kind of maybe something that would be up his alley. And I mean, who's to say when that might become available, but maybe he'll do that and bring his buddy Mark McCall back to coach the Irish team whenever he does.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Wes. Thanks to James. Thanks to Chris Jones earlier from the BBC. That wraps up this week's RT Rugby podcast. We'll be back again next week reflecting on those Pro 14 semi-finals and looking forward perhaps to an All-Irish final.